today on
Doomed.
It's his main thing. Right. He's got photos taken of him in newspapers holding lobsters. Now this guy is making millions of dollars telling people to emulate lobsters. This is the problem, right? We could have made millions if we'd just been like, no, 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 really. You be the lobster. Be the lobster you want to see in the book.
Nathan Robinson of Current Affairs joins the show, where we discuss the man tearing up the bestseller list himself, Jordan Peterson. Who is he? Why is everyone buying his 12 Rules for Life? What is this bullshit he's peddling? Is he the intellectual we deserve? All this and much, much more on today's episode of Doomed with Matt Binder. Hey everyone. Yeah, I know. This is where I usually tell you to support the show without spending a dime by going to iTunes and leaving a review. But did you know you can now also support this show with money? That's right. I've hopped aboard the Patreon train, and I'm asking you all to jump aboard with me. Go to patreon.com/MattBinder, and for a measly $5 a month, you can help support this show. I'm looking to grow this little endeavor, and I want to be able to do even cooler things than what the show is doing now. Plus, you'll get weekly bonus content in addition to this regular free weekly episode. Okay, so why give this show your hard-earned $5? I'll just let this episode do the talking. Joining me now is Nathan Robinson. He's the editor of Current Affairs and the author of Trump, Anatomy of Monstrosity. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. Nice to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, you know, I wanted to have you on this show because, Well, actually, I've wanted to have you on this show for something else you wrote earlier, but I guess the way the news just moves nowadays, it's so hard. You had a great article on Ben Shapiro.
But that seems ages ago.
It does seem ages ago. And you know what? Maybe I'll have to have you on again in the near future to talk about him. I mean,
Can't we talk about something nice in the world?
The show is called Doomed. I don't know what to tell you, man.
Okay. All right. Sure.
But I guess it makes sense that, you know, we go from Ben Shapiro, who mainstream media views now as the conservative intellectual. I mean, I guess that's a job now that entails attacking high school students for standing up to the gun lobby. And we go from that type of intellectual. Well, you go from that type of intellectual, and now we're going to your latest, which is this great article you have on Jordan Peterson. And for those of you who don't know who Jordan Peterson is, you're in luck. Because you're going to find out now, and also because before listening to this podcast, you were truly living a wonderful life. But Nathan, you wrote this article, The Intellectual We Deserve. Please, for people who don't know, and even for people who do know, tell us, who is Jordan Peterson?
I've been trying to ignore Jordan Peterson for the better part of a year now. Because we get emails periodically going, you know, why won't you write about Jordan Peterson? You should write about Jordan Peterson. And I've been trying myself not to think of him as very significant, but he is now the number one, I think the number one best-selling nonfiction author in the country. He is a psychologist a psychology professor at the University of Toronto, who became famous, I guess, 2016 he began to be notable because they were trying to add gender expression to Canada's Human Rights Act as one of the protected grounds against discrimination. And Jordan Peterson, Professor Peterson, spoke up and made a stink about this and said that he wouldn't use students' preferred gender pronouns and raised the possibility that if this law went through, he could be prosecuted for refusing to use students' preferred gender pronouns, which was not true. That was false. But then he started doing So he kind of made the news because of that, and then he started doing I don't know when he started doing the YouTube show, but he does a YouTube show, and he has a Patreon, and he got quite a lot of a following, and he does this sort of mixture of a few different things. First, a very strong criticism of the social justice movement and of the left.
He says
he's not a conservative, that he's a, quote, classical liberal, but that means conservative, and he is a conservative.
Right.
But then he also does other things, which makes him different from Ben Shapiro and some of the other conservatives, which he does a lot of self-help. His new book is a self-help book. And also a lot of lectures about psychology, mythology, religion, Jordan Peterson's Guide to the Bible, Jordan Peterson's Guide to Ancient Myths, that sort of thing. And so it's this combination of a very strong criticism of the left and this speaking to the disaffected and giving them. His book is called 12 Rules for Life, and it is just a set of prescriptions. It's self-help, how to be a better person living your best life. And so that mixture of self-help and his sort of academic work on mythology and psychology and his criticism of the left has sort of attracted him quite a huge following, and he was making something like $80,000 a month on Patreon.
Jeez.
And he has, you know, like 500,000 Twitter followers. I can't remember how many YouTube fans, but it's like 500,000 or 1,000,000. It's quite large, his following.
Yeah, I mean, that's Chapo Patreon money, except Peterson is one guy.
One guy.
That's a lot of money for one guy to be making monthly off Patreon. That's incredible.
And that's just Patreon, because, of course, the book now is the number one bestseller. Right. So,
and, of course, you know, his salary from being a professor.
Right. So he's gotten very wealthy.
Right. And so 12 Rules for Life was sort of his, I guess, his moment in the sun. Like, that's when the book that made him famous, I guess. But he had one before that.
Sure. Yeah. It was a less popular tome.
I guess it was just 6 rules for life, and there just wasn't enough.
No,
people.
This one has many, many, many rules.
It wasn't too little. It was too much. Got it.
Yeah. So he's written 2 books. His first book was an academic book. It was published through Routledge, which is an academic press. And it is called Maps of Meaning, and it is his 600-page magnum opus. It took him 15 years to write. It's sort of a statement of everything that he believes about everything. And it hasn't supposedly it's a psychology book. He's a psychology professor. But it hasn't really attracted much attention in the field. As far as I can tell, it kind of disappeared without a trace shortly after publication. So I dug this thing up, and a good portion of my article is about his first book, which I think offers a good insight into what this man's mind is actually like.
Right, right. And everyone should go to currentaffairs.org and read. This article really is great. And everyone listening to this should listen to this podcast, obviously, and then take what you heard here and then get more from that article. But can you just give us a small, like, sample of, like, what this first book really shows us, I guess, about Jordan Peterson?
Okay. So, well, Jordan Peterson is a professor of psychology, but he is a little bit unusual in that he's a Jungian. So he's a follower of Carl Jung. And that's a little rare these days. And the book is sort of... This is a book that you really have to... It's very hard to describe.
Right.
It's described as a new hypothesis exploring the connection between what modern neuropsychology tells us about the brain and what rituals, myths, and religious stories have long narrated. And on the back, it says it's a, quote, ambitious interdisciplinary odyssey drawing from the worlds of religion, cognitive science, and Jungian approaches to mythology and narrative.
Let me just pause you for a second.
Yeah.
What does any of that mean?
Well, that's the coherent bit. That's the part.
That's like, incredible.
I understand what like drawing insight from religion and I know a little bit about what cognitive science is. This book is 600 pages, and most of it is unintelligible. It's full of... And this is not because I just don't know anything about psychology. I mean, the first thing is, like, it's very easy to be anti-intellectual. I mean, you pick up a physics book, you don't know... You might not know what's in it if you haven't studied physics. So you got to be very careful before you just pick up an academic book right. and dismiss it, everything in it as nonsense. And in fact, one of the I actually did in the article at first dismiss one piece of this as nonsense, and a psychologist came to me and goes, no, actually, we do use that in the field. All the rest of it's nonsense, but that we actually do use. so you gotta be very careful if you don't actually know the field. But it becomes pretty clear when you read this that this is just his elaborate set of personal theories of. Basically how myths have developed over time and how myths are a constant and how evolution is linked to the creation of various kinds of myths and how they're similar across cultures. But every time you try and describe the book, you kind of lose the thread because the book is not very easy to understand. In fact, it's impossible to understand because I argue that most of it isn't saying very much. And I'll just give you like two sentences of the prose here so you can see what I mean
right.
And why I'm having difficulty. Here's a bit that I quote in the article. Procedural knowledge generated in the course of heroic behavior is not organized and integrated within the group and the individual as a consequence of simple accumulation. A procedure A appropriate in situation 1 and procedure B appropriate in situation 2 may clash in mutual violent opposition in situation 3. Under such circumstances, intrapsychic or interpersonal conflict emerges. Then moral reevaluation becomes necessary and behavioral options are rank ordered or moral systems are devastated. Now... some of that sounds coherent, right? So, like,
yeah, I feel like I was following along up to a point.
Yeah, he says, like, so one procedure is appropriate in one situation and another is appropriate in another. And you go, okay, well, yeah, that's sort of true. But what do you mean by procedures? What kinds of situations? What do you mean by clash? What do you mean by intrapsychic conflict? What is a moral reevaluation? So most of it is so vague that even if you can interpret it as having meaning, he hasn't been very clear on what the meaning he intends is. And I'd argue that that's intentional. That's a particular style of writing that people who don't have much to say use, is that they put the work on the reader to try and figure out some meaningful interpretation rather than explaining what they actually mean themselves.
Right, right. I gotta say, I'm usually someone who's on top of these type of guys, these grifters who take advantage, I guess, of young right-wing men. And Peterson sort of Peterson was already big by the time I figured out who he was. And when I first started looking into him, I just kept thinking to myself, man, this guy sounds a lot like just, you know, you take him out of his niche and put him in a new niche and you have he's a carbon copy of someone like a Sam Harris.
Yeah, but he's actually quite different from Sam Harris, because Sam Harris is all about science and reason, and Jordan Peterson is a lot. It's funny because Jordan Peterson decries the postmodernists. He says that postmodern neo-Marxists are destroying the world. But in fact, Peterson's a lot more like a kind of postmodernist writer than a scientist.
Right. What I'm sort of saying though is, you know, Sam Harris is often out there saying he's being misinterpreted because he's often saying, you know, he sort of has the same thing where he writes things that are just either just plain obvious, just things that we know in life that he just turns into intellectual writing by using a different set of vocabulary, or it's just so vague that you literally can just take your own set of beliefs and say, oh yeah, he's agreeing with me, and that goes across ideological spectrums.
Well, I do think though that there is a difference in that Sam Harris will make claims that can be argued about, right? So Sam Harris will make a claim like, science allows us to determine what moral values are. And you can have a debate with him about what science is, and he'll explain his vision of science. And, I mean, I disagree. I think he's profoundly wrong about that. I don't think science can determine our moral values. Right. but people have had reasoned debates with him. Jordan Peterson is so slippery that you can't even pin down what he means. And in fact, Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson have had several discussions together, and you see this contrast come out in their discussions, where Sam Harris spent the first hour just trying to figure out what Jordan Peterson meant by the idea of truth. Because Peterson's idea of truth is very obscure.
Right.
And they couldn't agree on this, because Sam Harris fundamentally is kind of an empirical guy, and Peterson is a storytelling mythologist. And so it creates very different, very different sets of approaches. And I think one of the things about Peterson, so one of the things that brought Peterson to popular attention was an interview he did on the UK's Channel 4 with a presenter called Cathy Newman. And she, it was a kind of a hostile interview, and many of Peterson's fans were very angry afterwards, because they said, well, Cathy Newman was very unfair to Jordan Peterson. She was putting words in his mouth. And if you go through the interview, that's exactly what she is doing. She's constantly going, saying things like, so you're saying that women shouldn't try to succeed? And he goes, no, that's not what I'm saying. And she goes, so you're saying that men are just better, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But actually, and so everyone goes, look, here is a hostile feminist journalist trying to make the Jordan Peterson look like a sexist, which is sort of true, but it's also true that one of the reasons that you end up, that all interviewers of Jordan Peterson end up going, well, so you're saying, is because it's almost never clear what Jordan Peterson is saying. Right, he's so abstract and so qualified in all of his statements that you constantly have to be going, wait, so are you saying what? What are you saying?
Right. The funny thing is, actually, I feel like you could even still swap the names with Sam Harris, down to the point of his fans saying that you're always taking him out of context, that you're not getting what he's saying. It is. I mean, there is. Maybe it's not the same beast, but it definitely is some sort of mirror image going on there.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, okay, if I do see a similarity, and the one similarity I do see is that I think both of these guys do not really make an effort to make themselves understood,
right,
to a critical audience.
Yes.
And then they get angry when they're misinterpreted.
Right.
And this is a very common tendency, and I think, as a writer, I always feel like I have the responsibility to make sure people are not misinterpreting me. But what a lot of these guys do, and Charles Murray is exactly the same, right? Charles Murray,
yes,
will say something that sounds super racist, and then when people go, hey, that sounds super racist, he'll go, no, 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 it was a technical, empirical claim, and you misunderstood it. Well, you know, even if that's true, it's kind of your responsibility to also think about how what you're saying sounds, and to say, look, I'm not saying this, what I'm really saying is this. And I think these guys often play a game where they intentionally say something that sounds super provocative, even if they mean something that's a little more technical and narrow, and then when people react as you would expect they would react to something that sounds super racist, the guys go, oh, look, you're an idiot, you don't understand science and logic.
Right, exactly. No, that's definitely what's going on there. It's definitely a play. A smart one, maybe, if you're in that line of work.
No, but, it's fantastic.
Right, and you know, just looking at some of the names that Peterson has, you know, the shows Peterson's appeared on, like, it really does. Like, I was looking at this list of his media appearances, and I was just like, oh, this makes complete sense. He's been on Stefan Molyneux's show. He's been on Gavin McGinnis's show, Joe Rogan's show. And then, you know, you brought
Dave Rubin.
I was about to say, you brought up classical liberal before, and who is the premier classical liberal nowadays? Dave Rubin. I mean, really,
he's the last liberal.
Right, he is. He's the last liberal left, right? I guess that's why he's able to make so much money off of Patreon as well.
And the Koch Foundation, I think. Right. I hope I'm not wrong about that, but I thought Dave Rubin was also, like, had big dark money funders.
Oh, he definitely has dark money funders. You know, that guy is so, like, I mean, it's obvious what he's doing, but I mean, the fact that he's able to play his young, you know, right-wing audience as if he's not that. He's someone on the other side who just happens to always have right wingers on and never talks to anyone on the left. But apparently,
this is what's fun. Yeah, no. I mean, this is, you're making the exact correct point here. And I think this is so funny. And I wish that the more honest among these guys, these guys' friends would just acknowledge this, which is, These figures like Rubin, like Shapiro, always say, oh, all I'm interested in is debate. And the left just wants to shut down debate and discussion. And they don't believe in discussion or free speech. And it's like, okay, but when have you ever had anyone from the social justice movement on your show? Never. You're not interested in debate. Ben Shapiro never even has guests on his show. It's just him talking into the microphone for an hour, right?
Right.
And Dave Rubin has, like, he'll have Jordan Peterson, then he'll have Ben Shapiro, then he'll have Sam Harris, then he'll have Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson at the same time. And you're like, where's the debate? It's just all of you agreeing that the left doesn't like talking as you just talk to yourselves.
Right. And I mean, listen, like, I fundamentally obviously disagree with the right. In fact, I probably dislike or disagree is probably too not strong enough of terminology sometimes for some of these guys. But I will always, you know, a little part of me on the inside that has a bit of respect for the guys who go on shows on the left. Well, they don't have to be big. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about, you know, your average right winger or a libertarian or whatever. And then, you know, on the left, we have guys like, and maybe I'm a little bit biased here because I worked with him for a while, Sam Cedar, who has this is never-ending open call for any right-winger or libertarian to call in. You get to come prepared. He has to take you on the spot, and you guys have a debate. I mean, Right. Where is that on the right? It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you have is you have things like, you know, Tucker Carlson will invite the he'll find some feminist who thinks that, like, the name of the city of Manchester is sexist and it should be renamed Peoplechester, and they'll find the most out there caricatured version of the left they can find, and then they'll have it on just so they can, you know, make fun of them for 10 minutes, and that's what they'll do because they're not interested in, and you see this with Jordan Peterson, right, too, which is, like, if you were interested in taking the views of the left seriously, you wouldn't caricature them as postmodern, neo-Marxist, totalitarian, authoritarian, what have yous. I mean, you would engage seriously with their ideas. And also, frankly, Ben Shapiro, I wrote that piece in December, he never responded. And I know he knows about it because he mentioned it in a speech that he gave. He goes, this guy wrote an article, I've never heard of him, he's not as important as me, right? But he never responded to any of my arguments because he couldn't.
Right. No, I mean, these guys, they just don't have, like, even, you can't even really, like, let's say you even wanted to consider Fox News. I don't even think you can, because when it comes down to something like TV time or cable news, it really becomes who has the most media training, not who has the best argument. It really is just a game, a play of who knows how to actually work the game.
Yeah, I think that's very important. But one thing is that the guys, people on our side really need to figure out how to work the game, because, you know, it's true that sometimes, you know, Jordan Peterson makes people look bad in interviews. He quote, wins the interview. And the reason he wins the interview is that the people who are sensible, sort of liberal journalists, they don't know how to interview him well. And he's very good at running circles around them. You know who also is like this? Richard Spencer is like this. Richard Spencer was on Al Jazeera and he was on Vice. And both times he made mincemeat of the interviewers because he knew the kind of questions that they were going to ask, but they didn't know the kind of answers that he was going to give. And so it made it so that they couldn't actually pin him down or make him look as bad as they wanted to make him look.
Right. I remember W. Kamau Bell had Richard Spencer on his CNN show when he had a show on CNN. And I'm watching it and I'm just thinking to myself, like, listen, I'm actually someone who thinks that, you know, there could be value in having an interview or having someone like Richard Spencer on your show. But you have to be prepared for him so you can make him look like total shit to anyone who's coming into this and doesn't know who this guy is. So, you know, if you're not ready to do that, then no, you shouldn't be interviewing someone like a Richard Spencer or anyone on who's a part of this right-wing grift. Whether we're talking about white supremacists or your I guess you can call them your run-of-the-mill conservative.
Yeah, well, right. So if you watch a Jordan Peterson interview, it often goes something like the questioner will say, well, you've said that you don't know whether men and women are capable of working together. Well, what do you mean? I think men and women are capable of working together. And then Jordan Peterson will reply, I'm not saying they're not. I'm saying we don't know, because men and women have only been in the workplace for 30 years. It's still an experiment. Men and women haven't been together in the workplace for very long. We don't know the set of rules by which they should interact. We don't know what's permissible in terms of flirtation in the workplace. Nobody's defined the rules. What are the rules? And then he'll turn it on the interviewer and he'll go, so what are the rules? And the interviewer will go, I what? Right? And he'll just start improvising in a way that the interviewer is left flummoxed. And Jordan Peterson will make a claim like, he'll go, well, why are women allowed to make suggestive displays in the workplace but men aren't? And the interviewer will go, what are you talking about?
Right.
And Peterson will go, well, women wear makeup, don't they? Well, what's makeup for? It's to be attractive. Well, there you go. And the interviewer will just be left, like, not knowing what to do.
it really almost does sound a little bit, and this is to give, I feel like I'm giving Donald Trump a little bit of too much credit here for saying this, but it sounds a little bit Trumpian too, in a way, in the way that Donald Trump, just in his speeches, will just, you know, when he's on fire, will just jump from topic to topic, no coherent thought, to the point where, you know, if you try to, you know, touch on something, it's just so much, and then it looks like really does look like you're piling on this poor guy who's just trying to tell the truth, you know, like.
Well, actually, one really interesting thing was the way that liberals thought that Donald Trump lost the presidential debates with Hillary Clinton, but I don't think he did, and I watched those debates and I didn't see the same thing where. The way they evaluated Trump's performance in the debates was they went, oh, look, this answer was totally incoherent. All the facts in it were wrong. It rambled. But that's not how Trump's audience saw it.
Right.
Trump's audience saw, like, Trump aggressively confronting Hillary Clinton and going, like, what about the emails? What about the emails? And they were like, yeah. And so there are a few different perspectives from which you can see these things. You can watch a Jordan Peterson interview and say, oh, Jordan Peterson is doing horribly in this interview because nothing he says makes sense. But if you're a fan of Jordan Peterson, you're watching the interview going, look, Jordan Peterson is crushing this interviewer because she doesn't know what to say in response to his answers. So these guys often triumph because they know their audience and they know what looks like crushing their opponents to their audience.
Right. It's like, it is analogous to even it's totally analogous to all these guys because, you know, like you were saying, like, you know, you have this liberal host, mainstream liberal host talking to a Jordan Peterson or even like a Donald Trump. And well, let's not include Trump in this one because I don't think Trump is that bright, but you have this liberal host talking to a Jordan Peterson and the liberal host and Jordan Peterson and the liberal host's audience may be playing chess, but Jordan Peterson's audience, they're not playing like third dimensional chess. No, they're playing checkers.
Well, or like, I actually, it's funny that you bring up chess because I was thinking about chess actually. I was thinking, because someone on social media goes, oh, I wish I'd see Robinson and Peterson have a debate. And I was thinking, well, no, you can't debate Jordan Peterson because to have a debate, you have to agree to a particular set of rules about what constitutes an argument and what constitutes refuting that argument. It's actually, I liken it more to as if you're playing chess with someone who like has their own ideas for how the pieces should move. Like, you know, everything's a queen. Like, you can move whatever piece wherever you want at any time. It's like a child playing chess. And what do? You can say, no, those aren't the rules, but they can go, actually, I won. And you go, no, you didn't. And they go, well, actually, I did. I think you'll find that I won. And then you're just left in a no, you didn't, yes, I did kind of back and forth. And that automatically means that you've lost. So there are certain people where when you engage them, if you're not cognizant of the game that they're playing, and actually this was true at Trump's debates too, where, especially in the primary debates, if you watch the Republican primary debates, Trump would just disregard flagrantly all of the rules. Like, the rules were you can't interrupt anyone else, and he would just interrupt constantly. And then the moderator would go, Mr. Trump, you can't actually interrupt the other people. And he'd go, okay, okay. And then he'd interrupt them again. Or he'd just go way over his time. And they go, Mr. Trump, that's enough. Mr. Trump, that's enough. And he'd just keep going because he knows that if you just disregard the rules, there's nothing anyone could do to stop you.
Right. Listening to the rules isn't going to get you remembered after that debate.
Mm-mm.
Everyone just remembers, and the way you go about it too isn't like you're just, you know, you were unaware, like you knew you were breaking the rules, but you had to because what you were saying was important to get through.
Mm-hmm.
So then it makes those rules makers look like they were the ones trying to stifle the truth.
Well, think about it. I like that you brought up media training because, like, think about, like, guys like Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro, he has a book called How to Crush Liberals in a Debate, and it's all a series of tactics, none of which are really, like, well, this is how you address an argument. They're all things on how to flummox them and how to make them look bad. Because Ben Shapiro isn't trying. He says facts don't care about your feelings, but he doesn't care about facts. Facts don't care about your feelings is a piece of rhetoric. It's a piece of very effective rhetoric. He's trying to make clips, YouTube clips of him crushing someone. And it doesn't matter if when you go back to the transcript later, you realize that the thing he was saying didn't make any sense or the study he cited didn't exist. And that's actually, those are both things that I pointed out in the article that I wrote about him from clips where he'd supposedly crushed someone. And then you look back and his argument didn't make any sense. But that's not what he's trying to do. He's trying to make a clip. He's trying to have a good piece of television. And Trump knows this. This is why Trump is the president right now, is because Trump understood that the presidential campaign in 2016 is based on the command of media, not the command of facts.
Right. That's totally what it is. And the thing is, I hate to go off this tangent on Trump now. For a long time, I gave Trump credit for maybe he was an idiot in every other aspect. But when it came to media, he knew how to play them because that's what that really is. You know, he's a real estate agent. He's a reality TV show host, whatever. But when it came down to it, all that shit was only possible because he knew how to play the media. And this whole time, I always thought it was just a talent he had. But the more I got to view him as president, the more I'm thinking, no, Trump just literally like bumblefucked, like stumbled his way into this shit. The media is just so stupid they always fell for it, thus making Trump look like the genius.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell, right? I mean, I mean, he's obviously he's not at all a smart man in a lot of ways. I think he does have some kind of P.T. Barnum sensibility for putting on a show.
Like Vince McMahon.
I do think he kind of has a talent for that. I do give him credit for that because, you know, people are just obsessed with him. You know, Slate has an entire podcast that's just like a daily podcast dedicated to him. You know, maybe he's stumbling, but my God, it's quite a lot of success for someone who's literally just stumbled their entire life. I still find it hard to believe that you can actually just stumble into the presidency. I do think that he, like, and the number one rated reality show on television for a long time. I think he does have a knack for knowing how to distract people. Maybe if it's just, it might just be shamelessness. It might just be that he's willing to say things and do things that other people aren't willing to do because they have scruples. So you might not call that talent. You might just call that like, you know, being a horrible person.
Right. I mean, I'll give Slate the pass for having the podcast on him. I mean, he is the president of the United States, so I get why there's a podcast about him.
But we didn't have an Obama cast.
There's probably similar podcasts that just weren't called the ObamaCast because they didn't have that cult. Well, that's not true because there was a cult of personality around Obama, a huge cult of personality around Obama. But I guess, I don't know, liberals probably respond better to that than who knows. Who knows the reason for that? But there definitely is something to be said about, I mean, Trump wasn't an especially great real estate guy. He wasn't an especially great TV show host or reality TV guy.
Well, he had the number one reality show. He beat all the other reality shows.
But it's because he already had that whole aura around him that he was able to build over many, many years of being this.
Yeah, I think that's for this Trump thing, this fake brand of Trump as wealth and success. He has at least produced that. Right. He might not be good at real estate, but he is definitely good at self-promotion.
Right. So let's just get back. You know, I was just thinking also, again, off track here, that Ben Shapiro has a book about how to win debates against liberals. I mean, that's like me writing a book about giving tips to basketball players. You know what? That's probably like Ben Shapiro writing a book about tips to basketball players.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I think if the rumors are true that he's only like 5'4", I've got only about maybe an inch or so on Ben Shapiro. So,
yeah, but as I say, he's not trying to debate liberals, but it is a good set of rules for how to make liberals look bad on television.
Right. And one thing getting back to Peterson that you said that caught my eye was how he looks at things like you brought up men and women working in the work together in the workplace, and how, you know, it's an ongoing experiment. Now, you would think someone who is an intellectual, an academic like Peterson would want to take part in this experiment then, except he's just so set, it looks like, in upholding these traditionalist ways that I don't see how you argue that the experimentation is the reason for all this. Because then wouldn't the answer be to take part in this experiment and try out the things and figure out which is actually bettering society or best for humanity?
Well, you know, I'm trying to be very careful because I know what Peterson, the way he responds to things. And so I'm careful about saying, oh, he doesn't want to take part in this experiment, because if you asked him that, he might respond to you and go, no, of course I want to take part in the experiment. I believe that it should happen. I'm just saying that I think we should be open to the possibility that it's not possible for men and women to work together. So, he finds ways to wriggle out of stuff. And I don't want to, I never want to say that I know his position on anything, because you rarely do, because he's always been so vague. There is no Jordan Peterson position a lot of the time, or at least no one that can be understood or discerned from reading him or listening to him.
Maybe there is no Jordan Peterson. Maybe this is all just a mirage.
Well, I say in the article, I say that you can sort of play a game called Pick Your Peterson, where it's understandable why people on the left think he's alt-right. And there are a lot of guys, his fans aren't just alt-right people. And I know this because I've talked to some of them who really aren't alt-right. They are just, they're white guys, but they consider themselves real centrists. They might not like Charles Murray, but they say, Peterson's different. I've had a lot of guys, Peterson's different. He's not like those people on the right. He's not alt-right. And so it's very easy to construct an alt-right interpretation of Peterson, a centrist interpretation of Peterson, a kind of liberal who's been betrayed by liberalism vision of Peterson, because he leaves open so many – a Nazi Peterson, because he leaves open so many possibilities through all of his vague language.
Right, right. It's this thing where these guys are able to get away with all these different – they're literally able to sell books based on this because people are buying this stuff, assuming it's speaking to them. But we're talking about people of 100 different ideologies, 100 different backgrounds. And it's not because this work is actually this broad, all-encompassing, it can speak to anybody. It's more like it's so open for interpretation, like you said, that he doesn't mean it in a way where it's like, yeah, it's really a book for anybody, because he doesn't even really know, I think, what exactly this book is for, like who that type is.
Well, look at the if you look at the
other
actual
than being a, other than obviously being a desperate young white man, obviously.
Yeah, I think that is the general characteristic. I think, I mean, he's said that 90% of his YouTube audience is male. and I'm sure it's disproportionately white, disproportionately, well, I don't know about the economics of it. But if you look at the rules, I mean, they are, this is typical of the self-help genre,
well, this
honestly.
Is great, because I actually wanted to bring up these rules, because I looked up the 12 rules, the actual 12 rules, and I honestly had to check it on multiple different websites, because I really couldn't tell, even on the second or third site I stumbled upon, whether I was reading like a parody version of these 12 rules.
Well, one of them is like pet cats.
Exactly. I couldn't tell if this was someone like joshing on it, like literally like taking it and saying, let's try to trick people into seeing just how insane some of these 12 rules can sound.
And can I tell you, the chapter on petting cats, you would think would be pretty straightforward. But I tried to read the chapter on petting cats. And it, the way it starts off is, I have a dog. And my dog is a German Shepherd. And my daughter's, when my daughter got this German Shepherd, and he describes the entire history of his German Shepherd, of his daughter buying the dog, what tricks the dog can do, what nicknames they have for the dog, just tons of facts about his dog.
You know when I had to do that? When I had to write a college paper back in the day, and I really had to just fill, you know, it needed to be a 1,000 words, and I was writing it, and at the end, I'm only at like 800, and I'm like, shit, I just gotta fill in some bullshit.
Let me, And then he says, well, I'm telling you about my dog because I don't want the dog people to feel left out of my chapter about cats. Let me tell you about some of the psychological studies that show why dog people would feel left out of a chapter about cats. Right, so we don't get to cats till like halfway through the chapter, because it's just nothing. It's just, and one of the things, if you read the article, the thing that I love the most in the article that I wrote is the 3,000 word transcript of Jordan Peterson speaking. We commissioned a guy to transcribe a piece of Peterson's actual speech from a lecture, It's just the most rambling nothing you've ever heard.
Is that his Billy speech or whatever?
Billy and the Pancake.
Right.
Where he's supposed to be analyzing a children's book to explain what the children's book has in common with Jungian archetypes. But instead, he tries to tell this long story about some time when he lived in Boston and he tried to feed a child and the child wouldn't eat, and it just goes absolutely nowhere. Right. It is unbelievable. It sounds someone pointed out that it sounds like when Grandpa Simpson tells a story on The Simpsons, and it just goes on and on and on and goes nowhere and has a million tangents. I recommend everyone read it to get a sense of how coherent Jordan Peterson actually is.
It really is something else. And speaking of, you know, you brought up Grandpa Simpson. I mean, just looking at rule one of his rules, like, I feel like all of our grandparents have left millions of dollars on the table by not writing this book about, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Because rule one is stand up straight with your shoulders back. Are you kidding me? I mean, that should be it. Rule one, one page, tons of white space underneath it. That should be it.
Yep, stand up straight. Well, he has a long discussion about lobsters in the first chapter. You know, that's the lobster chapter. So,
like the crustacean, like lobsters.
Yeah, So, stand up straight. Rule two, treat yourself like someone you're responsible for helping. Again, this is something that sort of sounds profound, but the only reason it sounds profound is because he said it in a way that's a little confusing.
Isn't that just the golden rule?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, it literally is, like...
treat yourself like you'd like someone to treat
you. Let me tell you, those guys who wrote it, those hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they wrote it more coherent than this guy.
Well, the Golden Rule is very beautiful and succinct. The problem with the Golden Rule is that it's so clear and succinct that you can't make any money off of it. What you need to do if you want to make money is find a way to make... There's a tactic, and I think this the way this works is very interesting, which is you take some piece of wisdom that everybody knows, like do unto others. And what you do is you make it confusing, but you make it so that if someone does the work of trying to understand it, they get the insight. And then the person feels like they're smart for having figured out the thing that you... It's like if someone took your possessions and buried them or hid them, and then you went and found your own stuff, and you were really happy at finding stuff, but it's your own stuff. The happiness, you shouldn't feel, or like, you know, someone's kidnapped your child, you get your child back, and you're happy at the kidnapper, right? You're like, no, they're the one who hid this thing from you. They are the one who made this process difficult.
Right. Oh, man, let's just keep going, because these rules are something else, you know? So we got rule three, where you make friends.
First is good posture. Second is just the golden rule.
Right. Third, we have make friends with people who want the best for you. I mean, really now.
Have good friends rather than bad friends.
Right.
If you have bad friends, then it'll be worse than if you have good friends.
Now, I don't know how prevalent this rule is, but like I've heard many a parent say something like, you know, that person isn't looking out for your best interest when they're talking about maybe a friend you've brought over who they see as someone who might lead you down the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this doesn't sound like something that
this is just make sure your friends are good people. Okay, all right. Rule four is compare. Okay, so rule four is compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not who someone else is today. Now there is something there, okay, which is like measure yourself by your own standards, not other people's standards.
Right.
Okay, but that's not meaningless. It's just a very conventional piece of wisdom, and it's not original at all to Peterson.
Right.
So he's repackaging things that come on like quota-day calendars, and then making them, as I say, more confusing than they need to be. Just say, judge yourself by your own standards, not by other people's.
Right.
Done.
Exactly. Well, at least rule four, though, I could see, you know, someone going to somebody and paying them for them to instill rule four in them. So
sure.
To give Peterson the benefit of the doubt, let's say he's one for four right now.
No. I think some of these are meaningful rules. The point is that they are not original rules, and that he's making them seem more profound than they actually are.
Right.
But some of them do offer actual, genuine help and insight, which is that's the reason that people who sell self-help books still sell a lot of copies, is because there is stuff in there that's useful. Things like, you know, focus on sorting out your life, and you go, oh, well, I should focus on sorting out my life.
Right, exactly. So okay, let's do rule five, right?
Rule five, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. I love this rule because he seems to constantly be on the verge of disliking his own children. If you, the anecdote, the like long-winded anecdote in the piece is all about like how you need to make sure that your children are grateful to you, because if they're not grateful, you will despise them. And you're constant, whenever he talks about kids, you're constantly thinking, wait, this sounds like a you problem, not a me problem. This sounds like something between you and your kids, not a universal between parents and their kids.
Right. Being that we're on the parental child relationship here, let's just get to this really quick.
Mm-hmm.
So in one of his books, was it 12 Rules or was it the earlier one, where he writes a letter, he publishes in his book a letter he wrote to his own father. That just seems to be him telling his father of all of his own great accomplishments, patting himself on the back, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, the letter, and we've posted the full letter on Twitter, and it's linked to in the article. He includes the letter kind of all of a sudden with no context in Maps of Meaning. And the letter is basically a letter where he goes, "Dear Dad, I thought I'd tell you what I've been thinking about and working on and try and explain my book to you." And he tries to explain what his theories are. And you can imagine just being his dad and sitting there going, what is something wrong with our son? Like, what is our, is he okay? Is he, do we need to like intervene in our son's life? Because it's just total incoherent rambling nonsense. But the funny thing is that at the very end of the letter, he goes, oh, and I hope you, I'm glad you and mom are well. Thanks for doing my tax returns. So it's very clear that he's been, like, Mr. Big Thinker, Jordan Peterson, has been off thinking big thoughts while his parents sort of organize his life for him.
Right. I mean, I think it actually tells us a lot about, I mean, combine that letter with rule number 5. And I think it might give us a little bit more insight into Jordan Peterson than I think the insight Jordan Peterson is apparently giving to those young males who are his audience.
Yeah.
I mean, now, it really seems like there's some sort of relationship. I mean, I'm not going to speculate beyond that. I'm not going to say exactly what went on because who knows. Right. But something seems to have been – there is some sort of important moment or ongoing event or occurrence that happened in Jordan Peterson's life between him and his parents. And it is – It seems to have, looking at rule number 5, seems to have manifested in his own relationship with his own children. And yeah. I think we might be, all these 12 rules might be a little bit of a self-help for Jordan Peterson, actually.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's difficult to know, but every time he mentions children or parents, you do feel like it does cause you to think to yourself, where did you get this from? Right? Because he does constantly talk about the fact that, like, it's very natural to hate your children. You're like, what?
And I gotta say, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them is a great way to make sure that your children dislike you.
Good point. That's a fantastic point. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. When you get Ray Jordan Peterson's parenting advice, you go, you really feel terrible for anyone who is raised using that advice.
And we're gonna probably have like a whole generation of kids grown who were raised by, I guess, Gen Xers and millennials who took Jordan Peterson's advice, who like hate their parents, hate them.
Well, okay, that's probably good because then maybe they'll all become leftists.
Right, right. That's true. So thank you, Jordan Peterson.
Thanks for poisoning all the kids against their Jordan Peterson loving parents.
So rule 6.
So rule 6 is really important because rule 6, I think, captures one of my central criticisms of the whole philosophy. Rule 6 is called set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And I think this is so insightful because he basically has a philosophy which he repeats over and over, which says he's very against activism, okay? And he doesn't even understand what activism is. He says activists are basically people who carry signs on sticks and they wave the sticks to show how superior they are, right? He doesn't understand that activism is an attempt to influence the political system in order to enact a particular set of changes to affect people's lives. That doesn't register. So he thinks activists are basically doing nothing but virtue signaling, no matter who they are. And he says, don't be an activist, don't do politics. What you need to do is focus on your life, making your life better. You need to clean your room, stand up straight. You need to focus on, as he says, setting your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And if you take this seriously, it means that until your life has been made perfect, you can't go and criticize how the economy and how the political system work. You have to accept those things as they are because the problem is with you. And until you've sorted you out, you can't blame anything else. And I think that is one of the parts of this that leads to a retreat from politics and a belief that in turning inward and in the sort of conservative philosophy of I don't have to think about other people, I should just think about myself and do what's best for myself. It's very solipsistic. It's very focused on the self.
I think I could even wrap up rule number 6 even more succinctly here. People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, again, he's just taking these well-known sayings that people have used for decades, if not hundreds of years, and just repurposing them in actually worse format.
Yeah. Well, no, they are worse because people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones is a fairly good rule. It's just a caution against hypocrisy. This goes a little further in discouraging people from caring about important social issues.
That's true. That's a good point, actually. So it's not exact. You're right. Okay.
It's worse.
Right. Right.
You take cliche. The cliche is useful, and then you make it bad and useless.
So rule 7. Let's get to. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient.
Okay, no shit. Yeah, you know. Do meaningful things, not things that, okay, you know. But here's again, it depends what it means. Yeah, so sometimes you do need to do expedient things. We all want to do meaningful things, but sometimes you need to do expedient things. The useful advice you could offer for people is when you should do expedient things versus meaningful things, right? That's the serious question. By saying pursue what's meaningful, not what's expedient, you're giving people a useless piece of advice because, like, obviously we want to do things that are meaningful, but sometimes we can't. So the question is, when do you sacrifice, when do you say that the means justify the ends? Those are difficult questions, and he's not helping people answer the difficult questions. He's just giving this useless platitude.
Right. So let's get. I feel like it flows perfectly what you just said into rule 8. Tell the truth, or at least don't lie.
Okay, yeah, right. So tell the truth, or at least don't lie. So first we get tell the truth, right? Which we go, okay, well, but what if we in a situation where we can't tell the truth? Okay, well, don't lie. You know, this is not, like, obviously, this is just, obviously we want to tell the truth, and we want to not lie. This is just a restatement of be a good person, do the right thing. The question is not whether we... everyone holds this value. The useful advice you could give people is thinking through the situations in which you do have to lie and when lying might be justified. And that's really hard. So he avoids the hard stuff in favor of the easy, useless stuff.
Right. I guess you could say that for every one of these rules, actually. Mm-hmm. So rule 9 now. Assume that the person you are listening to might know something you don't. I mean,
I love this. Yeah. This is actually a really good rule, yeah. Right? This is about empathy, and this is about, you know, humility.
Which funny is funny coming here, from Peterson.
Yeah, right. The funny thing here is not that it's a bad rule. It's a great rule. It's the fact that it's coming from Jordan Peterson, who doesn't listen to anybody, right? He just talks. He doesn't. If you assumed that the person that you were listening to knew something you didn't, then he would listen to leftists instead of calling them neo-Marxist postmodern totalitarians.
Right.
He would show some humility instead of just confidently denouncing everything. So it's a good rule. He just doesn't understand it.
And speaking of funny coming from Peterson, I guess there's no better rule than rule 10. Be precise in your speech.
Yeah, I love that. Be precise. Jordan Peterson, the world's most precise man. My invitation to listeners is to pick up a copy of Maps of Meaning and just cruise through it, remembering that this is a guy who thinks you should be precise in your speech.
Right.
Or read that monologue. It's just hilarious.
Right.
Again, good rule. I try and be precise in my speech too. But you know,
you're being very precise. If this was one of your rules, I would say this is great.
Yeah.
If we were reading off of Nathan Robinson's 12 rules, I'd say this this up as a win for Nathan.
Yeah, but this is the world's least precise man, so it's just funny.
Rule 11, do not bother children. Here it comes again. Do not bother children when they are skateboarding.
Fine, yeah. Let kids play. Yes, kids need to play.
Again, isn't that what these young 18 to 21, most of them college students are doing in college when they're taking part in this student activism that Jordan Peterson seems to have such a problem with?
Well, you can let them skateboard, but they're not allowed to, I don't know, care about social causes.
So he is actually being extremely literal here.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
talking
just
skateboarding.
He just means don't bother them when they're skateboarding.
He's a big fan of like ollies and grinding rails and kickflips. It's probably his like, how do you do, fellow kids moment.
Yeah. No, it's true. So yeah, skateboarding in particular, don't bother kids when they're doing it. Okay.
And then, as you mentioned before, there's the rule 12, which is pet a cat when you encounter one on the street.
Which actually, again, bad rule. Some cats have diseases.
Right.
You shouldn't just pet every street cat. It might bite you. You have to be discerning with cats on the street. You have to check whether the cat looks like it wants to be petted. So, again, this even though it sounds like an innocuous rule, is actually a bad rule anyway. So, rule 12, I think we can discount. Everyone likes... I mean, you should pet cats. Petting cats is good. But, you know, still bad formulation of the rule.
I really feel like there should be like a rule 13 here, and it should be something like, you know, going by these other Peterson rules, something to the effect of children should be seen and not heard, or something like that.
Yeah. He has a lot of that. And in fact, at the end, he has, I cite this, which is sort of supplement to the actual rules. He has a section where he advises people, what shall I do to ennoble my body? I should use it only in the service of my soul. What should I do with the most difficult of questions? Consider them to the gateway to the path of life. What shall I do with the poor man's plight? Strive through right example to lift his broken heart. So he goes on with more stuff that he thinks you should do, and it's more cliche about... I mean, he phrases it in a way that's confusing, but when you actually break these things down, they're things like set a good example, and, learn from your challenges, and you should try and be true to yourself.
Right. Right. Now, if this interview between us happened maybe a few days ago, I would be probably approaching my last question here for you. But being that this article that came out March 14th, and we are now doing this interview about 3 days later, I can talk to you about this. Jordan Peterson has read your article, and it seems like he has, unlike Ben Shapiro, a lot to say to you about it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Let's go over that.
Okay. So, yeah, Jordan Peterson. But Ben Shapiro, because Ben Shapiro is smarter than Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro sort of sensibly knew that the best approach to my article was to just not try and reply. Jordan Peterson can't resist a fight, so Jordan Peterson started tweeting a bunch of stuff about how wrong it was. And it's just fun. It's hilarious what his responses were. So, you know, my article goes through and analyzes his writing, shows that none of it means anything. The parts that do mean things are usually either wrong or platitudes. Sometimes he misinterprets stuff completely. He's incoherent, right? His responses, his first response is something like, Robinson tries to discredit me by using an unpunctuated transcript of my speech. As if we'd added more punctuation to that long monologue, it would have somehow made it more coherent. So that's like, which is just stunning to me. I mean, I could go through and punctuate it if we really wanted to, but the punctuation is not the part of it that's making him look bad.
Peterson's one of those guys who comes across a comma and you actually hear him go every single time.
Yeah.
Take a deep breath.
Well, and I tell you, anyone who thinks the transcript is unfair should watch the clip, which is worse and more difficult to get through, or just reenact it with your friends. We read it out loud in my house, and it was really fun. Just have someone impersonate Peterson and do the whole transcript, and it's great. So another criticism he had was I made fun of him for saying that people, he said, people don't want to be happy. They want to not suffer. And I said, well, I want to be happy. And his reply was, no, you don't, Nathan. Well, you don't want to be happy. And the reason his argument for why I don't want to be happy is that suffering is far worse than pleasure is good, right? So people... happiness doesn't bring us as much pleasure as suffering brings us pain. Pain is more extreme than pleasure, even on the other end. And of course, that doesn't mean that nobody wants to be happy. That's just stupid, right? It means that like your first priority is not to be tortured, because being tortured is terrible. But it doesn't mean you don't also want to be happy if you can avoid suffering. You know, this is just the way he thinks. It's very silly.
One more thing I want to make sure we say about this, though, is... he came across an image that you had in your article. Yeah, I think it's best if you tell it.
Okay, so just to explain, you know, a few years ago, a friend and I wrote a parody of academic nonsense called Blueprints for a Sparkling Tomorrow.
I already love it.
Essentially, we wanted to make fun of this kind of style where you are diagnosing the whole universe and giving your crazy theory for how to fix it. And it's funny because the book is kind of a lot like Maps of Meaning in some ways, because it has ridiculous, crazy charts that we made. And in fact, there are similarities, like, you know, the subtitle of Maps of Meaning is The Architecture of Belief, and ours is Blueprints for Tomorrow. And, so there's this sense in both of them of, like, I've figured out the structure of the world.
Were you aware of Peterson's book when you wrote this one?
Oh, no. We did this in 2015. So, nobody had heard of him then. So... no, we were just making fun of this kind of style generally. Actually, more poking fun at leftists. So we just printed this thing, on our own, and it was fun. But the funny thing is that we actually included in it a segment on why human beings should model themselves on lobsters, which I think is funny because, like, that was us just making up the stupidest shit we could think of.
And it's literally one of his examples and one of his rules.
Main example. It's his main thing. Right. He's got photos taken of him in newspapers holding lobsters. Now this guy is making millions of dollars telling people to emulate lobsters.
Why didn't you write that book exactly how it was, but pretend you were serious about it, Nathan?
I know. This is the problem, right? We could have made millions if we'd just been like, no, really. You be the lobster. Be the lobster you want to see in the world. So anyway, we wrote this and forgot about it. But the funny thing, so I cited in the article this thing where we did the lobster reference and said that he was clearly plagiarizing us. And then we had an ad for our parody nonsense book, which was, it just said, if you liked Jordan Peterson's Maps of Meaning, you'll love Blueprints for a Sparkling Tomorrow.
That is fantastic.
And Jordan Peterson seemed to believe that we were using the opportunity of the article to piggyback on the success of Maps of Meaning to promote our own very serious academic work. So he's like, the most hilarious thing about this article is that even though it's critical of me, halfway down it says, if you like Maps of Meaning, you'll like our book.
Amazing. You know, have you noticed that a lot of these guys, I mean, it's clear he either didn't read the article, which is definitely possible, or didn't read the whole thing, which is probably even more possible, but do you notice that, I think this actually might be a little bit to it, a lot of these Peterson types, the right-wing grifters that we've talked about, a lot of them lack, like, societal, like, personality cues. Like, they miss things that an average human being, part of society, would know to be, oh, that's a joke.
Yeah. Well, Jordan Peterson doesn't have a...
lack of awareness there.
He doesn't have a sense of humor,
right?
So he really shouldn't engage with people on Twitter, because Twitter's a place of wit, where the person who's kind of the funniest wins, and Jordan Peterson just has absolutely no sense of humor. I actually, as I was reading 12 Rules for Life, there was a funny joke in it, and I thought, that's weird. I thought Jordan Peterson had no sense of humor. And I realized it was from the foreword, which Jordan Peterson didn't write.
Ah, that's too good. That's too good.
Oh, that's why this joke is funny. But Jordan Peterson, the most he manages as a joke is he's like, you might feel like a lobster, especially when you're feeling crabby. And then he has a smiley face.
Oh,
in the book.
God.
There are smiley faces in the book, by the way.
Oh, boy. I mean, I don't even think he knows his audience then, because that feels like something someone who believes in, like, the cliche of what his audience, like, the generation his audience is in. Like, oh, I'm writing for people who are reading this are young, depressed millennials. They love smiley faces. But the type of people who would be reading his book would not be that trope.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
he knows that his audience are millennials. He wants to appear, millennial. Look, mentioned his audience, not understanding social. I'm very sympathetic to that, because when people don't understand social cues, it's not their fault. When it was very severe, it places you on the autism spectrum. It's not.
Oh right, I'm not even talking about that. Right.
It's something that, like, well, so I'm torn between, because I do think that, like, my sense is always that I want to criticize and target those people who are powerful. And Jordan Peterson is a best-selling author. I want to tear him to shreds, right. Because he's manipulating people. He's spreading poisonous ideas and confusion. I think he's a bad person.
He's the person in power in this scenario, without a doubt. Yeah,
right. He has a lot of money and a lot of influence. Jordan Peterson's audience, I feel a little differently about, because I'm sure some of them are like awful alt-right people. But I do think, and I say this in the article, right. People have called him the stupid man smart person.
And I'm glad you're bringing this up, because actually one of the things I pulled from the article is this exact line, and I thought it was really good. Yeah.
And I said, well, that's a little cruel, because I think that, I talk about him instead as kind of the desperate man smart person, which is... The people who are getting things out of him are often people who are adrift, without meaning. They want someone to explain the world to them. He's been called a father figure, right? He gives them rules. He tries to make sense of the world. He says, don't listen to the feminists and the social justice warriors. This is why your life is bad. I can help you. I'll be your dad. I think there are probably a lot of people who, like, haven't really had support from their dads.
Does he actually say that, though? That he'll be your dad?
It says father figure on the inside of the dust jacket.
Listen, I can understand someone, the person absorbing this material, looking at him that way. But for him to outright say that, this is easily the most disturbing part of it to me.
Either him or his publisher, because the publishers choose the book jacket, so it might just be the publisher promoting him this way.
Right. But I gotta say, if I wrote a book and they wanted to promote me as someone's father figure who wasn't actually, like, unless I was writing a book specifically for my 2.5-year-old son, and it was for his eyes only, I would say to the publisher, listen, you cannot do this under my name and I will not allow it.
Yeah, no, it's true. So I don't really know that much about the actual. I don't know the people who are Jordan Peterson's audience very well. I don't speak to many of them. I know someone who's a current affairs subscriber who's emailed me likes Jordan Peterson a lot, and he's a very nice and intelligent man. I do try to be sympathetic to people who are lured in by this kind of person who promises you everything. And that's why I'm also sympathetic to people who voted for Donald Trump, because Donald Trump Absolutely. Appealed to people who, are confused. They don't know what's going on in the world. They're scared, and he whipped up their fears.
I always looked at it as this way. If you're someone who, and there's plenty of people like this in this country, who have lost almost everything, who feel distraught that they're just literally hanging on by a thread, they're a paycheck away from losing their home, they can't send their, they can't provide a better life for their kids, and then this guy comes along and says, I'm gonna fuck it all up, then you're gonna say to yourself, well, I got nothing to lose.
Yeah. It's a hard world to be alive in, right? Living is hard.
Right.
and for a lot of people. And it's not just people who are the very poor. It's just like being mortal is a difficult thing. The human condition is scary. So I try not to make fun of, and a lot of the pieces about Peterson have really gone like, oh, well, he's for dimwits. And I try and think about it this and go, well, no, let's not call people down. I'm on the left, so I try and sympathize with the people. And that's all people. That's broken people and people who are not that savvy. And
across ideologies, too. I mean,
yeah,
because if you want to call them the opposition, it's not like the people who are being duped by these right-wing grifters. It's the grifters.
Yeah, it's the grifters. Those are the people I despise. The people right. I despise
because they know like what they're Trump. Doing and they're making bank off of it.
And people like Shapiro and people like Jordan Peterson, who are intelligent and manipulative and have no empathy whatsoever. Those are the people I really can't stand. But their supporters. For their supporters, I want us to offer those people something better. I want there to be. I don't want to say a left-wing Jordan Peterson because you don't want any kind of Jordan Peterson. but this is like that. Oh, we should have a Breitbart of the left. No, you shouldn't. The world shouldn't have any Breitbarts.
Right.
But I do think that where is our program to give people meaning?
I guess you could say something like nothing with how they run their organization or how he runs his brand, but. Someone as influential on the left, I guess, saying the correct things.
not just a person. I want a set of ideas right. that are very clear, that help people understand their lives, that help people give people goals and values, and that aren't just like pet a cat.
So I guess this sort of brings me to the last thing I really wanted to talk about, and just to set the stage here for everybody so they know exactly what we're talking about. It's what can we do to rectify the situation and combat people mm-hmm. like a Jordan Peterson?
Yeah. So, well, one question is, how does he have the kind of appeal that he does? And one thing is, and I've seen a lot of people who like him react this way, is they say, well, look, he's this professor who takes his knowledge and spreads it on YouTube and makes it accessible, and he tries to bring it to a mass audience. And I've been in academia. I was in a sociology graduate program before I started Current Affairs. I'm still in it, actually, technically. But one of the things about academia is that there's often kind of a contempt for people who speak to a broad audience. They write popular books, not academic books, and popular is considered a kind of slur, which is weird, because right. it should be good for something to be popular. And I think academics need to take more responsibility for helping people understand the world. I've thought that for a long time. I have a thing on climate change, an article on climate change, where I talk about why climate change denial occurs. And one of the reasons it occurs is because nobody's even met a climate scientist. Like, they don't right. know these people. These people are sort of these weird, distant eggheads.
Right.
So they need to be out. I thought there should be like a listening tour of climate scientists all around the country to every town in America where they're all listening to people's doubts and trying to explain and assuage those doubts and change public opinion. Because it's like people don't know. They don't have people they can consult. They don't know how to figure out the truth.
We need to get like Bill Nye in a room with them and tell them how to build a brand like that.
Yeah, and it's not just Bill Nye. That's the important thing. It shouldn't just be like one guy who's the science guy. There is a science guy, and right. we know his name.
It should be Bill Nye, one of the many science guys and gals.
Bill Nye, a science guy, not Bill Nye, the science guy. Right? It's like, I think there needs to be a lot more. People who know things have a responsibility to share their knowledge with other people, and not to like be contemptuous of people for not knowing things. And go, ugh, they're just idiots. How could you ever be such an idiot? But go, okay, well, people are the product of their circumstances. What are you doing to try and share knowledge, to make people excited about knowledge, to try and be constructive instead of sounding really patronizing?
Yeah, no, totally, though. I mean, there's to be honest, what it sounds like to me is you want some more liberal indoctrination in our schools.
Well, no,
I'm just joking with you. But
it's an interesting distinction, because I also wrote an article about how climate change is taught in schools. And there was an article, actually, in the New York Times about how high school teachers are struggling to deal with students who are skeptical of climate change, because the teacher will say things like, well, it's in the book. Just read the textbook. You're wrong. Right. And the student will have all these talking points that they've gotten from their parents who watch Fox. And they'll go, but what about the fact that, you know, the global, there was an ice storm in wherever recently. And the teacher, because high school science teachers often just know what's in the book and they don't actually know that much about science, the teacher won't really have good answers beyond, like, well, just shut up and listen. Right. And I think there needs to be a better approach, which is trying to understand people's doubts and not get angry with them for their doubts, and try and help them work through to the truth in a way that's not trying to get them to accept it as a matter of your superior authority, but them reasoning their way to a conclusion.
Right. No, I mean, I had that experience in high school myself, where there were teachers who just literally, you'd go in the class and sit down, and for 45 minutes, they would just be, they would teach you nothing, and they would, their whole lesson plan was basically, yeah, well, we don't have enough time to do it here, so you got to go home and read the actual stuff that's going to be on the test. And it's like, yeah. So what's, that's not what, like, then how are there teachers who can actually teach within this 45-minute period? I don't get why you're pretending it can't be done.
It's weird to me when anyone dismisses Americans as idiots, right, where they go, wow, the American public is just so stupid. Because obviously it's true, but we also know that the American public education system is terrible.
Right.
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 Like, how is anyone supposed to know anything when they go through, after they've come through that?
And just moving back to how we combat this, it's sort of like also just not even on a strategic level in terms of, you know, how we present our own ideology and beliefs and ideas and systems and the type of people we put forward to doing that. I also think there's the policy component, where we probably won't be having as many young white men who were distraught with their place in the world if we had policies that leftists advocate for,
right,
that help people.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and you see this, like the white supremacists, I mean, they pick up support in desperate places. Because they come along with an answer. They come along with someone to blame, and the left isn't present in these places, and the far right is. And it's our responsibility to have an alternative. You know, we might not think that we should have, that should be our job, but it is, if we want to actually practically achieve a better world.
I think that's a perfect place to leave this conversation.
Okay.
Nathan Robinson, editor of Current Affairs, author of Trump Anatomy of a Monstrosity. I wrecked that. I'm sorry. Go to currentaffairs.org. Read the article. It is, you know what, let me make sure I say the name of the article here. I don't know if I even named it.
It's called The Intellectual We Deserve.
Right. I think I did it, now that I hear it again. And I guess let's give Jordan Peterson a little shout-out. I was looking it up, and if you live in New York City like me, he'll be speaking at the Beacon Theater in NYC in the end of March. Tickets are only $100 each. And, oh, I'm sorry, still, it's all sold out already.
Oh, man. I bet it's sold out in like 10 minutes. Everyone wants to see Jordan Peterson.
Beacon Theater is owned by MSG, and it's about a 3,000-seat venue. So if you want to sort of understand just how important it is for people like Nathan Robinson to come on this show and then write articles for his his website speaking about Jordan Peterson, that's a good reason right there.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan, have a great day. Thanks a lot. It was really
great. Matt. Great pleasure.
Sometimes after certain conversations on certain topics, it really is best to take in what we just discussed and remind you all that to support this show, you can go leave a review on iTunes. It takes just a few seconds. You can also subscribe for free on iTunes or whatever other podcast listening app you use. And now, if you'd like to support this show monetarily and help fund this weekly free episode, plus bonus material and more, go to patreon.com/mattbinder. And if you're sick of typing in patreon.com, you can go to the domain legionofdoomed.com, and that'll forward you right there too. It's only $5 a month to help grow this program that will better your life without telling you to act like a lobster. I mean, come on. And don't forget, you can find all the links regarding where the show can be downloaded, a link to the Patreon, and more at doomedpod.com. All right, that's all for today. See you next time on Doomed.